This is Audible.
Not the Impossible Faith: Why Christianity Didn't Need a Miracle to Succeed. Written by Richard Carrier, PhD. Narrated by Richard Carrier. Introduction. A common apologetic argument for the truth of the Christian religion is that its origins were too improbable for it to be false. This argument has appeared in many forms over the years, but most of the usual ideas are combined into a single popular effort by James Patrick Holding, alias Robert Turkle, a Christian minister and one-time prison librarian. J.P. Holding's argument is that the origin and success of Christianity in the ancient Roman Empire was so improbable it must have been based on a true story of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This book refutes his argument. But in the process, it educates the reader on numerous fascinating aspects of ancient religion, history, society, and culture, and explains in entirely natural terms why Christianity was a success, when it actually was. The Dark Horse Rides. J.P. Holding is something of a dark horse in the apologetics community. He is very popular online. I often travel the country speaking to humanist groups near and far, and I always meet people who know his work. They are usually Christians once seduced by his rhetoric, who later lost their faith upon discovering how horribly he'd misled them. It's perhaps not surprising, then, that professional Christian apologists seem inclined not to associate with him. I suspect they don't want to be seen as endorsing his shoddy research, unprofessional demeanor, and unrepentant reliance on fallacious argument. Indeed, he insults whoever exposes his errors and often responds by simply making things up. Originally, J.P. Holding had assembled his arguments in a lengthy and rambling online effort, which he constantly edited whenever criticized, so establishing its original text was no easy matter, though as he now presents it in 5 languages, I assume he doesn't edit it much anymore. He then greatly summarized his case in a convenient book form, The Impossible Faith: Why Christianity Succeeded When It Should Have Failed, published by Zulon Press, 2007. He advertises this as, quote, a thesis so explosive, an atheist paid $5,000 for an answer, end quote. As it happens, I was the scholar paid, even more than that, to compose a well-researched refutation, which Holding conveniently never directs anyone to. Nor does he ever name me, and his book doesn't even mention my refutations, much less address them. He clearly doesn't want his readers to know where to find them or ever even read them. That all but amounts to an admission of defeat. The White Knight responds. My original critique is still available online. Holding did attempt a rebuttal, and I revised my online work in response to that, although his response consisted almost entirely of ignoring, misrepresenting, or misunderstanding nearly everything I wrote, while the rest consisted of substituting groundless assertions for evidence. The book you are now listening to reproduces my entire critique still cataloged on the secular web, but is revised in 3 respects. I've added this new introduction, I've taken what is still in Chapter 19 online, Responses to Critics, and reintegrated all that material into the other chapters where it belongs, so here there are only 18 chapters. I've edited everything in various ways, and often what was an endnoted digression now appears in the main text, and many sections have partly been rewritten. In the following 18 chapters, I will compare Holding's claims and arguments with the actual facts of ancient history, identifying errors in his research, fallacies in his reasoning, and his frequent, I suspect deliberate, distortion of the facts. Holding presents 17 factors, quote, where Christianity did the wrong thing in order to be a successful religion, end quote, and concludes from this that the only way Christianity could succeed under those 17 hostile conditions was because it was a truly revealed faith, in particular, because it had the irrefutable witness of the resurrection behind it. Each of these points will be addressed in its own separate chapter, with the final chapter on a more general point pervading all the others. Dark Horse Dead in the Water. One thing that's missing from Holding's paper is any sort of formal logical or statistical argument. The gist of it goes like this. Only if the evidence for the resurrection was truly unassailable would Christianity have succeeded at all. It succeeded. Therefore, the evidence for the resurrection must have been truly unassailable. If the evidence for the resurrection was truly unassailable, then we too should believe Jesus rose from the dead. But really his argument hinges on probabilities. Even granting everything Holding argues, That Christianity would have succeeded without unassailable evidence of the resurrection is not impossible, only improbable. Despite his rather hyperbolic language, even Holding must admit that the odds of Christianity becoming successful without being true could not be zero, even on all of his own assumptions. Human behavior is not that predictable, nor are there any demonstrated historical laws that make any conclusion about historical cause and effect beyond all probability of error. So Holding can only mean that the probability of Christianity becoming successful, on all of his own premises and assumptions, is so low that we have no reasonable ground to believe it did. Unless the evidence for the resurrection was strong enough to convince even us. In Holding's version of the argument, the witness of the resurrection must have been irrefutable. I won't quibble about what exactly irrefutable means, since I'll assume he means the witness of the resurrection was, and therefore is, as irrefutable as the historical fact that Christianity was successful. All observers agree with the latter statement, and we certainly should believe any statement that meets the same standard, which is Holding's aim. However, how improbable would the success of Christianity have to be before we have to believe in the resurrection of Jesus to explain that success? Holding never says. Nor does he say how improbable Christianity's success really was. Yet without comparing those two estimates, it's not really possible to confirm the success of Holding's argument. Many fantastically improbable things happen all the time, simply because so many things happen. For example, that's about as likely as getting struck by lightning is often used as a cliché of an event so improbable it never happens, yet over 400 people are struck by lightning every year in the United States alone. Some people have been struck multiple times. Hence, our intuition often fails us when estimating the improbable. Normally, this is not a barrier to historical inquiry, since we need only ascertain the most probable cause of an event, given all we know. And usually we can say that, given what we know, the most probable cause is the one that is most probably true, and therefore worthy of belief, though maybe only a tentative belief, depending on how much more probable it is than alternatives. However, in Holding's case, this requires trying to sort out three crucial questions. Number one, is the prior probability of a miracle from God greater than the prior probability of any alternative natural cause that explains the same evidence? For instance, the prior probability of my being struck by lightning is a lot lower than my prior probability of catching a cold, because the latter is more common than the former. What is the prior probability of a miraculous resurrection? And what are the prior probabilities of any alternative explanations of the same evidence? Number two, what is the probability that a genuinely risen, and hence still living, Christ would actually produce all the evidence we have, including a church preaching immoral doctrines such as the subjugation of women and the persecution of doubters? Number three, what is the probability that natural causes would still make Christianity as successful as it was? All this follows necessarily from Bayes' theorem, which I talk about and describe and explain in my book, Proving History, Bayes' Theorem and the Quest for the Historical Jesus. But here, all you need to notice is that clearly miracles are less common than natural causes, just as getting struck by lightning is less common than catching a cold. Indeed, miraculous resurrections are obviously far less common than getting struck by lightning. But it's not always the case that a hypothesis with a lower prior probability is less likely true than another, since the probability of the evidence on either hypothesis can overwhelm that, no matter how low with respect to any other hypothesis the prior probability may be. In layman's terms, even though miracles must be extremely rare, since even at best we see few of them and have yet to establish even one with anywhere near the same certainty as we have for countless other causes of even very bizarre events in history, and therefore miracles must be extremely improbable, it's still possible to have the probabilities balance out enough to make miracle the most probable explanation among all alternatives. Nevertheless, this does require a substantial scale of evidence, a fact that also follows necessarily from Bayes' theorem, which follows a deductively valid argument and therefore can't be gainsaid. Does Holding have that kind of evidence? And does it tip the scales of probability in the correct direction? And does it do so enough to overcome the initial improbability of miraculous causes? He never says, nor provides enough information to guess. We must also rule out, of course, the influence of a deceiving supernatural power. For example, some force, like Satan, who could bring about the same results through supernatural influence as some Jews might allege for the success of Christianity. Holding does not make any effort to answer these questions, even vaguely. Thus, his conclusion can only be vaguely certain at best. Though this fact alone already leaves his argument dead in the water, since he produces no conclusions about the required relative probabilities and no definite conclusion can be reached without them, I will nevertheless set this aside and assume, merely for the sake of argument, that Holding's case succeeds unless we can show that some set of natural causes, which we know for a fact happen more often than miracles do, for example, natural causes that were not unusual or rare, were reasonably likely to have produced the same result, meaning the actual success of the Christian church. I will also assume for the sake of argument that all non-Christian supernatural causes that could logically be to blame are less probable than the most probable natural causes, whatever they may be. In other words, I will assume that if Jesus was not raised by God, then probably Christianity's success was due to natural causes and not, for example, Satan. Chapter 1. Who would believe in a crucified God? Precedents and distinctions. James Holding asks, who on earth would believe a religion centered on a crucified man? Well, the Sumerians, perhaps. One of their top goddesses, Inanna, the Babylonian Ishtar, queen of heaven, was stripped naked and crucified, yet rose again and, triumphant, condemned to hell her lover, the shepherd god Dumuzi, the Babylonian Tammuz. This became the center of a major Sumerian sacred story preserved in clay tablets dating over 1,000 years before Christ. The corresponding religion, which we now know included the worship of a crucified Inanna, is mentioned by Ezekiel as having achieved some popularity even within Jerusalem itself by the 6th century BC. The, quote, women weeping for Tammuz, end quote, at the north gate of the Jewish temple in Ezekiel 8:14, we now know were weeping because Inanna had condemned her lover to hell after herself being crucified and resurrected. So the influence of this religious story and its potent, apparently compelling allure upon pre-Christian Judaism is in evidence. Some Christians knew of the cult, too. The Apostolic Constitutions, written around 250 AD, mention the cult of Tammuz and Astarte, a common transliteration of Ishtar, as among the heresies of the early Jews. Origen and Hippolytus give important testimonies around the same time, about 225 AD. Origen discusses Tammuz, whom he associates with Adonis, in his comments on Ezekiel, noting that they say that for a long time certain rites of initiation are conducted. First, that they weep for him, since he has died. Second, that they rejoice for him, because he has risen from the dead. Apo nekron anastanti, the same language used regarding Jesus. Although the Sumerian records are incomplete and thus do not preserve an account of the resurrection of Tammuz, we do know his death followed the resurrection of Inanna. Even so, my point is not that the Christians got the idea of a crucified God from early Inanna cult. There may have been some direct or indirect influence we cannot trace. We can't rule that out. The idea of worshiping a crucified deity did predate Christianity and had entered Jewish society in pre-Christian Palestine. But we don't know any more than that. I always caution strongly against overzealous attempts to link Christianity with prior religions. I can't deny there are some intriguing parallels, including those between this story of Inanna and the story of the incarnation of the Lord told in the ascension of Isaiah. There are many important differences, but it is curious that in the Sumerian story, Inanna descends through the 7 gates of hell with a different encounter at each level, and her humiliation and crucifixion occur at the bottom, while in the Jewish story, the Savior, Jesus, descends through the 7 heavens with a different encounter at each level, and his humiliation and crucifixion occur at the bottom. Jesus also supposedly said he would be 3 days and 3 nights in the grave, according to Matthew 12:40, while Inanna herself was dead for 3 days and 3 nights. Of course, we are told Jesus was not actually dead for 3 nights, only at most 2, but it remains curious why there would be a tradition of his saying otherwise, a tradition matching that of Inanna. I admit parallels like this are worth noting, but they are too little to make much of. For instance, Jonah 1:17 also shares the 3 days and nights motif, and Matthew 12:40 explicitly draws from it, which probably derived from a common ancient concept of death. Therefore, we needn't imagine the Christians got the idea of a third-day resurrection from Inanna cult, either directly or through intervening religions, because they might have gotten the idea from the same cultural ideologies governing the construction of the Inanna myth and every other myth. So the parallels aren't the issue. Rather, my point is that we have here a clear example of many people worshiping a crucified God. Therefore, as a matter of principle, unless Holding wants to claim that Inanna really was resurrected, it appears that people would worship a false crucified god. Therefore, Holding cannot claim this is improbable. Holding has tried to protest that Inanna wasn't really crucified, but being humiliated by being stripped naked, killed, and nailed up in shame amounts to the same thing to any reasonable observer. The story itself emphasizes the humiliation of it. Holding asserts without any evidence that such treatment was not a humiliation in ancient Sumer, but it seems clear that Inanna was treated that way in the story precisely because it was humiliating to strip someone naked and hang their shamed corpse up in public view. Though we can't trace how far back this goes, such public hanging to shame corpses was certainly a practice more ancient than Roman times, even more ancient than Israel. It was already a method of legal shaming in the Babylonian Code of Hammurabi, and the Old Testament itself establishes the practice as so horrible it was a curse to God that could defile the land. At the very least, Holding has no grounds to claim that what was done to Inanna wasn't humiliating to Sumerians, especially when done to a queen. For like all ancient cultures, Sumer was also an honor-shame society, a fact Holding concedes, and in such a context, hanging up the naked, unburied corpse of royalty would surely have been among the gravest of insults. Holding also protests that Inanna was already revered before she died, but so was the god who had already proclaimed in his ancient oracles the vindication of his humiliated son and Christ, so the advantage was the same. Finally, Holding concludes that my argument validates his by proving, quote, a crucified deity would require a vindication to be worshipped, end quote. But there was no more evidence that Inanna was really vindicated by resurrection than Jesus was, and that is exactly my point. If people could believe she was vindicated without irrefutable evidence, then so too Jesus. Hence, Holding is certainly correct that the point of crucifixion was extreme humiliation as well as terror, and it was certainly a commonplace view held by the elite, especially the more snobbish, that to die in such a way was the ultimate disgrace and embarrassment. However, just because many people find some idea repugnant does not mean everyone does, nor does this mean it was regarded as repugnant by those who converted. Ancient literature, by far most of it written by the rich and well-connected, is full of disgust towards the humiliating careers of prostitutes or slaves, and yet there were still people even willing to choose the life of a hooker or a slave. Likewise, to be a gladiator was a shameful embarrassment among the rich, and yet gladiators could become famous and revered among the poor. For a more direct parallel, consider the cult of Attis and Cybele. This was a popular religion, with priests and followers all over the Roman Empire, yet it centered on the worship of a eunuch, the castrated Attis, and priests as a result castrated themselves in honor of their god. And this despite the fact that the emasculating act of castration was among the worst of embarrassing disgraces to the snobbish elite, just as crucifixion was. This point is demonstrated by a passage from Seneca, who, as a famous philosopher, rich landowner, and advisor to emperors, definitely represents someone deeply invested in the elite power structure. Seneca wrote of this practice of castration and acts of mutilation promoted by other popular cults, quote, if anyone has leisure to view what they do and what they suffer, he will find practices so indecent for honorable men, so unworthy of free men, so unlike those of sane men, that if their number were fewer, no one would have any doubt they were demented. As it is, the only support for a plea of sanity is found in the number of the mad throng, end quote. Thus, even something so foul and repugnant to an elite scholar like Seneca nevertheless commanded a large following. There can be no ground for claiming Christianity was any different than the cult of Cybele and Attis in this regard. One man's disgrace was apparently another man's holy salvation. Contrary to Holding's assumption, the most repugnant beliefs could command large followings. Holding still asks why the Attis cult then failed, as if he didn't know the Attis cult survived for centuries before Christianity took over the government, and only failed when it was actively destroyed. As decreed by Emperor Theodosius in AD 395, quote, we decree that no one shall have the right to approach any shrine or temple whatsoever, or to perform abominable sacrifices in any place or time whatsoever. Therefore, all who try to deviate from the dogma of the Catholic Church shall hurry to observe it, end quote. This consolidated and reinforced laws that had already been passing since 391. The penalties ranged from death to the confiscation of land and property. As a consequence of this, open persecution of pagans began in earnest. Some fled, some converted, and others adapted their paganism to be less offensive to their Christian opponents. Though some communities, such as Alexandria, had so large a pagan community as to thwart the exercise of imperial power. This was a state of defiance that led inevitably to riots and violence, including the burning of one of the two great libraries at Alexandria and the hideous flaying of the Platonist teacher Hypatia. Nevertheless, the philosophical schools in Athens, which attempted to find ways to make paganism palatable to the Christian authorities, remained active until they were forced to close by Emperor Justinian in AD 529, by which point the Western Roman Empire had long since collapsed and the Eastern Empire had its own endless troubles. After that, there was every incentive to simply join the crowd and become a Christian, and urban paganism completely vanished by the 8th century. Throughout this sad tale, it was always possible to defy the imperial edicts as long as no one noticed or couldn't do anything about it. Ultimately, paganism survived mainly in rural communities, the Pagi, hence Pagani, pagans, which were often beyond the reach of an overextended government. But open worship was suppressed. For example, paralleling and preceding the events in Alexandria is the fate of the pagan stronghold of Gaza. Gaza was mostly pagan in 390 AD, with only 280 Christians out of some 10,000 inhabitants. But when miracles performed by a new bishop sent to correct the city only won over another 163 converts, the rest of the city was converted by horrifying displays of force and cruelty. Holding's rhetorical question thus amounts to using the fact that Christianity outlawed the Attis cult into extinction as evidence for the inability of the Attis cult to survive because it was false, which is already a non sequitur. Therefore, when Holding argues that Christianity would either have died out and or thoroughly revamped itself, because that is what happened to the Attis cult, there is no logical connection between his premise and conclusion. Of course, it just so happens that Christianity did revamp itself, quite often throughout its growth, as I'll point out in chapter 18 and in the first part of chapter 2. And the original Christian religion of Peter and James did die out, replaced by the religion of Paul, which, among other things, abandoned Jewish law and practice precisely to ensure the religion's success. It was only by changing that Christianity survived at all, and it was only by seizing control of the acts of government that Christianity could finally eliminate its competitors. Holding likewise snipes at my supposedly having no grounds to say that the Attis cult commanded a very large following, even though I cite several scholarly sources surveying the literary and archaeological evidence, demonstrating it had a considerable and highly visible presence, certainly enough to establish that its membership empire-wide was very large, almost certainly in the hundreds of thousands. As I'll show in chapter 18, we have no evidence that in the first century Christianity was any more successful, as in commanded any greater a following, than any other cult, including the Attis cult. It's a fact that we have abundant archaeological evidence of the Attis cult all over the Roman Empire, but none whatsoever of a Christian presence until the 3rd century, at which point I openly allow that Christianity probably overtook any particular competitor, including the Attis cult, in size of membership. As I explain in chapter 18, only in the 3rd century does material evidence of a Christian presence anywhere in the empire begin to match that of even minor pagan cults. And indeed it might then have begun to exceed them. But of course, as I'll also explain there, Christian growth by that point has no bearing on Holding's argument anymore, as he himself admits. And before then, there is no evidence that Christianity was even as large as the Attis cult, much less any other competing religion. That's my argument, and it remains true. Therefore, it does no good to present examples of people who find something repugnant or embarrassing, especially from the literate elite. Christianity won over very few of those elite until it had positions of power and authority to offer them within a wealth-generating church hierarchy by the mid to late 2nd century, amidst an otherwise collapsing social system in the mid 3rd century, as I'll discuss in chapter 18. Rather, what we want to know is whether anyone would find a crucified God acceptable or even praiseworthy, and whether it was those very people who became Christians. That means we must study the attitudes of those who converted, not the attitudes of those who refused or attacked the religion. Obviously, many people rejected Christianity because it was repugnant to them in various ways, and probably would have rejected it no matter what evidence confirmed its truth. That's why Christianity never won universal acceptance until it had the power to compel acceptance under pain of death or exile or loss of property by the end of the 4th century AD. How converts differed from critics. When we engage this correct approach, however, we find there are two relevant facts that Holding omits from his consideration. First, the early Christians were in a significantly different social position than those who most looked down on the form of Christ's death, and we know they had credible reasons not to share the elite view when it came to Jesus. Second, among some Jews, there was a certain expectation that the Messiah had to be humiliated as part of God's plan to secure his triumph, and these Jews would not find a crucified Messiah repugnant. To the contrary, it would be exactly what they were looking for. The first point becomes clear when we read the early teachings in Paul and Acts and compare them with the teachings of the Essene community at Qumran. Like the Qumran community, the early Christians appear to have come from a disgruntled poor and middle class who had grown disgusted with the fundamental injustices in their society and government, especially social and economic inequities, as evidenced by the Christian desire, attested in Paul and Acts, to eliminate those very inequities within the church itself. For example, look at Galatians 3:28 and Acts 4:32-35. But also the execution of righteous men. The fate of John the Baptist is a case in point, executed by the state, yet still held in high esteem by a great many Jews. Many even expected God might raise John from the dead before the general resurrection of Israel. Holding argues against this, that those who thought Jesus was the resurrected John the Baptist either thought John was raised by means other than resurrection, or that this was done in anticipation of a general resurrection that was shortly to take place. I'm glad Holding thinks so, since that is in fact what the early Christians thought of Jesus, that he was raised, quote, in anticipation of a general resurrection that was shortly to take place, end quote, as I'll point out in chapter 3. But Holding seems to be getting ahead of himself here, since I mention this fact, that some believed, in the words of Mark 6:14, that John the Baptist is risen from the dead. I used this only as evidence that John was revered. So here it doesn't matter how or why John was raised. The fact that many Jews expected God would raise him can be taken as evidence that John was revered. That's the only reason I bring it up here. In any case, it's a contradiction in terms to say John was raised from the dead by some means other than being raised from the dead, so I'm not sure what Holding has in mind here, except perhaps an appeal to the entirely modern terminological dichotomy between quote-unquote resurrection and resuscitation, which I address in chapter 3. There were certainly many different conceptions of how someone could return from the dead in a new or healed body. But no matter how they quibbled over the details, bodily returning from the dead was still a bodily return from the dead. And here the issue is not the implied metaphysics of John's imagined return, but the fact that so many believed God would honor an executed man with such a privileged miracle. If John could be revered despite the embarrassment of execution, so could Jesus. This would have been no less likely had John been crucified. To the contrary, the outrage at this insult to his honor would be all the greater, and popular reverence for his unjust suffering all the greater for it. So as long as someone believed Jesus had also been a righteous man crucified unjustly, which converts always had to be persuaded of first, his crucifixion would have been no stumbling block at all. To the contrary, it would be testimony to his greatness. It would make him even more a hero than any other death could have. This was especially true among Jews and their sympathizers who already had a tradition of revering humiliated martyrs, and among the poor, disillusioned, and disenfranchised, who expected good men to be humiliated and murdered by the corrupt elites they despised. The first century Jewish historian Josephus offers an example of the crucified still being regarded as the best and noblest of men. He says many Jews cravenly gave in and abandoned God's laws when Antiochus crucified the Maccabean supporters. But, quote, the most excellent men and those with noble souls didn't care about this, but held more thought for the customs of the fatherland than for the punishment he inflicted upon them, end quote. Thus, exactly as predicted, Josephus held crucified men in high esteem, so long as they died righteously like Jesus. Indeed, Josephus uses a clever play on words here, he employs timoria, vengeance, punishment, which sounds almost exactly like timo, honor, hold in high esteem, hence implying that this crucifixion, though a punishment to Antiochus, was an honor to its victims, who stood firm before God. Hence, indeed, standing up to the man, as modern slang would put it, was a surefire way to win reverence among these groups. Obviously, the man did not feel that way. Hence, those who looked down on Christians for worshiping a crucified God were typically invested in the wealthy power structure, Jewish or Gentile. In contrast, we don't have on record anyone outside that structure scorning the idea. Though many may well have, just as jail time today can be a badge of honor or disgrace among the lower classes, depending on the circumstances. Hence, those of any class who were unconvinced that Jesus was righteous could certainly mock the manner of his end. Holding offers one piece of evidence allegedly to the contrary, although it is rather late and ambiguous. The famous Palatine Graffito of around 200 AD. Most probably this was written by a member of the middle class, free or slave, though we don't know exactly why or what he meant by it, or whether the author was mocking or merely depicting the crucifixion. And Holding can't claim to know this author wasn't well invested in the elite power structure by being dependent upon it and supporting it. After all, the location of it, inside the imperial palace, suggests otherwise. Holding thinks it doesn't matter that this is late, 200 AD. But he clearly doesn't understand my argument about social attitudes. In light of what I actually argue, the fact that this record is late does matter, for the social and political situation of Christianity had significantly changed by then, and pagan disgust or resentment was even greater. And since we cannot know what, if anything, is being mocked by the image, it's difficult to draw the conclusions Holding wants. For example, the fact that the God in this image is depicted as crucified may merely be because he was, while the only intended insult may be the God's depiction as an ass, as it is. Whether a God's crucifixion was being mocked would depend on whether the author thought the God was crucified justly or unjustly. Since we don't know what the author was thinking, we can't draw any useful conclusions. Holding also says there is no reason to believe the author was a member of the middle class, but the reason we conclude he was is obvious to anyone who knows Greek. The graffito is misspelled. In fact, the error is a common phonetic mistake that would typically be made by someone who knew Greek orally but was not very literate. Since no adult elite would be so inept in Greek, even Romans were expected to be fluent, and it was rare for the poor to write any Greek at all. It follows that, exactly as I say, most probably this was written by a member of the middle class. The location of the graffito inside the imperial palace further supports this conclusion. It likely originated from a member of the imperial staff. Finally, Holding has ignored all my explanations of what I mean by those who are, quote-unquote, well invested in the elite power structure. I very definitely intend a limited group who, as I say of Seneca, are so invested in the system that they would not be sympathetic to critics of that system, but would regard attacks on the system as attacks on themselves. Obviously, this did not include everyone, for there are copious examples of critics of the system, inside and outside Christianity. I'll cover some examples in chapters 2 and 12. So when we look at the early success of Christianity, in its first century, it was nowhere so successful as among the poor, the disillusioned, the disenfranchised, and Jews and their sympathizers, like the faithful centurion of Luke 7, verses 2 to 6. That Christianity won success principally among these groups is evident in Acts, where successes are achieved primarily within Jewish communities and synagogues, and elsewhere, most often by recruiting slaves and women. Roman citizens, or anyone of wealth or power, who were not already Jews or sympathizers, were rare among converts. In other words, Christianity was most successful among those very people who would have empathized most with the story of Jesus and could admire his unjust manner of death. And for at least a century, it had no known success with the very kinds of people who did scorn Christ's manner of death. Wealthy, politically connected scholars, whose writings are the only ones we have that scorn the manner of Christ's death. The fact that the early Christian movement began among those outside the elite social structure, and only later worked its way up the social ladder in later centuries, is the consensus view among qualified experts, and is almost too obvious to need proving. It's even explicitly admitted by Paul in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26. As far as we know, the highest-ranking post-resurrection converts in the first 100 years of Christianity are the centurion Cornelius, the proconsul Sergius Paulus, and Dionysius the Areopagite, if we trust Luke, the only source to report these conversions. But Cornelius was already a devout Jewish sympathizer. Just read Acts 10, verses 1 to 2, and Acts 10, verse 22. Likewise, the centurionate was a distinctly middle-class occupation, which contained its own daunting galaxy of social ranks, wherein disillusionment with the system, especially for a religious minority, would not be unusual. And though Sergius is a unique case in terms of social status, it's likely he was also a Jewish sympathizer, given his close association with the Jewish sorcerer Elymas Bar-Jesus, and the fact that Luke calls him a discerning man who wanted to hear the word of God, Acts 13, verses 6 to 12. Moreover, Sergius was certainly not an elite scholar, for surely if that were so, he would have left writings to posterity, which Christians would have eagerly preserved. I'll talk more about Sergius in chapter 13. So too for Dionysius, Acts 17, verses 16 to 34, since the writings attributed to him have been universally rejected as much later works by an unknown author, and members of the Areopagus were frequently of the same social rank as centurions, in other words, upper middle class. Moreover, by Roman times, this council could have included some Jews or Jewish sympathizers, yet we are not told what the prior religious convictions of Dionysius were. Nevertheless, Holding mistakenly claims I'm saying, quote, the ancient everyday man would not have held the same disdain for a shamed person, end quote. That is not what I'm arguing. I never claim there was any general difference. Rather, I'm very clearly arguing that certain members of ancient society would not regard the humiliation of an innocent man as shaming him, but as an insult to his honor, the exact opposite of what Holding argues. Holding doesn't seem to understand that I limit my point twice. First, I limit my claim to a very particular cross-section of people, which I carefully define, and not to the ancient everyday man as some sort of blanket category. And second, I limit my claim to attitudes towards the treatment of righteous men, and not to just any shamed person. Of course, contrary to Holding's denial of the fact, I have presented, here and in Chapter 8, a lot of evidence that certain people in antiquity did not regard humiliated martyrs as disgraced, but as insulted by unjust treatment, and rather than ceasing to revere them, revered them all the more, and hated all the more those who unjustly humiliated such good men. It thus does not matter what the Japanese have done, or what modern Iraqis do. Those are Holding's counterexamples, which are not only irrelevant, but also bogus. What matters is what the ancients did within the Roman Empire. And contrary to Holding's ridiculous claim that the masses universally approved all the values and behaviors of the elite, I present copious evidence soundly refuting him, in chapter 12 especially, but also in chapters 2, 5, and 17. Never mind that every single qualified expert on ancient culture agrees with me, including Holding's own favorite sources, Molina, Fox, Stark, Da Silva, and so on. Just read them for yourselves. Holding knows he can't find anyone to side with him, which must be why he only quotes, and at inordinate length, what other scholars say about completely different situations in completely different cultures. It is all the worse that what Holding claims about these unrelated cases is either irrelevant or false. It follows from the very nature of an honor-shame society that when those who deserve honor, like Jesus, are treated disgracefully, they are not abandoned in shame, but defended against such insults to their honor. This is true in Iraq and Japan, and the ancient Mediterranean. Shame a righteous man in either Japan or Iraq, and see how quickly the crowd turns against you and not against the man you insulted. Likewise, Holding seems not to know that hundreds of thousands of Saddam Hussein's own people gave their lives fighting against him for decades, a far cry from coming to admire the tyrant, as Holding alleges. Nor does he seem to grasp the difference between Iraqis defending Iraq and Iraqis defending Saddam. You need not share your leader's values to fight for your homeland, especially against meddling foreigners, and surely Holding does not imagine that all Iraqis shared or even accepted Saddam's twisted values. Likewise, Holding is apparently unaware of the several rebellions and social conflicts that have plagued Japanese history, especially in the 17th and 19th centuries, As with all such cultures, class discontent is unleashed when the elites fail to deliver the social harmony expected from them. Exactly the circumstances Christianity found itself in. A point made again and again by Molina, Da Silva, and every other expert I've read. Indeed, the entire history of Rome is the history of class struggle between the commons and the aristocracy, which often broke out into wars and protests. Consult any textbook on the history of the Roman Republic, especially on the most pivotal events, from the fate of the Gracchi to the social war to Caesar's political campaigns. The conclusion is clear. Holding has no evidence that a crucified God was a stumbling block to anyone who actually converted to Christianity. Presenting evidence that it may have been a barrier for those who didn't convert only explains the obvious, why those people didn't convert. But did those who converted share the same values and opinions on this matter? Not only has Holding not demonstrated they did, it's not even plausible they would. How things really looked. So it seems that Holding has no case here. Yes, someone who found the idea of revering a crucified man repugnant would need very powerful evidence to convert, exactly as Holding argues. But there is no evidence any such person converted, at least for 100 years after Christ's death. And after that, all opportunity to inspect the evidence would be gone. So Holding's argument turns out to be irrelevant to the actual history of early Christianity. Instead, with a lone exception, Sergius Paulus, as noted earlier and in later chapters. All those who converted within that period, insofar as we can assign them to any social group at all, do not appear to have belonged to any of the social groups who would routinely scorn the idea of revering a crucified man. Rather, they belonged to groups who would readily accept or even cherish the idea of a righteous man martyred for his principles. And for them, a crucified hero would be even more a hero, precisely because crucifixion was intended by the despised elite to be the ultimate humiliation. To deify such a man could easily be sold as an attractive FU to the corrupt powers of Judea and Rome. For them, the good man triumphs, despite their greatest efforts to destroy him in the most degrading way possible. Indeed, these very efforts at degrading honorable men were exactly the kind of thing the disillusioned despised about those in power. Ultimately, for a crucified man to be victorious stands as a testimony to the impotence of corrupt leaders, and that was the very thing the oppressed wanted most to believe, that there is a greater power the wicked elite cannot defeat no matter how hard they try. Obviously, a supernaturally victorious conqueror was what people wanted more, but there was never any such person. So for the Jews and their sympathizers and other social underdogs, the only heroes left were martyrs. For the only way left to claim that the corrupt power structure was really powerless was to point to someone who triumphed despite their every efforts to degrade him, as I'll explain in Chapter 8, and lacking any real such hero, only someone whose triumph was invisible to all but the eye of faith could win anything like wide support. That's exactly what the early Christians were striving for. That was the market niche they most ably exploited. And in that context, the Christ story was sure to be a hit. This is confirmed by the fact that the gospel did not really preach a God crucified. No one converted thinking they were worshiping a defeated, disgraced God. To the contrary, from the very beginning, the gospel preached a God crucified and raised to glory. Many a potential convert could find that attractive. Christ was a victorious God, receiving the ultimate honor, not a God defeated in humiliation. His crucifixion was only a temporary defeat. The God actually being worshipped, therefore, was not defeated at all. He lived and sat on the ultimate heavenly throne, his power attested on earth in the charisma, conviction, and miracles that belief in him inspired. I'll say more on that point in Chapter 13. Not everyone bought it, of course, but many would have, and many did. The crucified Christ was the ultimate hero, who soon would save us all from the awful, corrupt world we despise and can no longer control, while raining down punishment on the wicked elite who seemed to us so untouchable. That this hero had to die at the hands of elite conspirators in order to gain this ultimate power was not unusual. Many a god required just such a path, from the Sumerian Inanna to the Egyptian Osiris, to the Roman Romulus. I discussed Inanna earlier. Osiris was likewise murdered, dismembered, buried, then ascended to heaven to become the supreme father of the gods. Like the Inanna myth, the Osiris myth also contained curious yet inconclusive parallels with the Christ story. Although it's otherwise a very different tale, there are still a few similarities that might be too unusual to be coincidental. Both were sealed in their tomb or casket. Both were killed by 72 conspirators. Both rose on the third day after their death, and both resurrections took place during a full moon. Another god who submitted to being murdered in order to triumph was the well-revered Roman national deity Romulus, whose death and resurrection was celebrated in annual public ceremonies in Rome since before Christian times. Though again a very different story, the Romulan tale shared with Christ's at least the following elements. Both were incarnated gods. Romulus descended from heaven to become human and die. Both became incarnate in order to establish a kingdom on earth. For Romulus, that meant the Roman Empire. For Christ, it meant the kingdom of God, in other words, the church. There was a supernatural darkness at both their deaths, as in Mark 15, verse 33. Both were killed by a conspiracy of the ruling powers. Christ, by the Jewish and Roman authorities. Romulus, by the first Roman Senate. Both corpses vanished when sought for. In the earliest and canonical Gospels, Christ's tomb is found empty. No one sees him rise. Both appear after their resurrection to a close follower on an important road. Proculus on the road to Alba Longa, Cleopas on the road to Emmaus. Both roads 14 miles long or so, the one leading to Rome, the other from Jerusalem. Both connected their resurrections with moral teachings. Romulus instructs Proculus to tell the Romans they will achieve a great empire if they are virtuous. Both appeared around the break of dawn. Both ascended to heaven, according to Luke, for example, 24 verses 50 to 55, and Acts 1 verses 9 to 11. Both were hailed God, Son of God, King and Father, and in the public Roman ceremony, the names were recited in public of those who fled in fear when the body of Romulus vanished. Just as we know, quote-unquote, the names of those who fled in fear when the body of Jesus vanished, in Mark 16, verse 8. And in both cases, the story went that these people kept their silence for a long time and only later proclaimed Romulus a risen God, just as the women in Mark's account told no one, and in Luke's account, the Christians waited 50 days before proclaiming their discovery to the public. Just look at Acts 1, verse 3, and Acts 2, verses 1 to 11. Both Osiris and Romulus were dismembered. So was Orpheus and Bacchus before his own resurrection and ascension to heaven. And though Jesus is not dismembered, his clothes were. Look at Mark 15, verse 24. And clothing was a common metaphor for the body in Jewish thought. But this is a far more tentative parallel than the others. In any case, my point is not that there has been borrowing, just as I argued earlier, but that there were many gods who had to be killed to rise to glory and receive worship, so there was nothing unusual and thus nothing improbable in the same happening for Christ. Many expected a humiliated Savior. This idea of a suffering, executed God would resonate especially with those Jews and their sympathizers who expected a humiliated Messiah. Jewish scripture declared that the Redeemer of Israel, or the Holy One of God, shall be despised by men, and nations will be disgusted with him, yet he shall triumph. The people will bury him with the wicked, even though he was innocent, and he shall be numbered with the transgressors, just as the Gospel of Mark says. The idea that a chosen one of God must suffer total humiliation and execution at the hands of the wicked is a major theme in Isaiah. Thus, N.T. Wright's claim that messiahship in Judaism, such as it was, never envisaged someone suffering the fate he suffered, is demonstrably false, insofar as Isaiah 52-53 and Daniel 9 both envision such a fate, and other evidence clearly allows it. Even David, a common prototype of the Messiah, sings in Psalm 22, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? For I am a worm, and a reproach to men, despised by the people, and all that see me laugh and scorn. This song set up a Jewish model for a crucified Davidic savior. The pre-Christian text of the Wisdom of Solomon also declares that the wicked will condemn to a shameful death the holiest man of God, because they are blinded by their wickedness and do not know the secret purposes of God. And it said this righteous man, a son of God, who is given a shameful execution, will be raised and exalted by God to avenge his death. This was a lesson that would automatically apply to the Messiah, who would be, by definition, a blameless and righteous man. For those who understood, or were taught, the Jewish idea of sin and atonement, this would make even more sense, since in order for Christ's death to properly atone for all sins, his sacrifice had to be the most extreme imaginable. And hardly any sacrifice was more extreme than submitting to crucifixion. Such an atoning sacrifice was overtly anticipated in Isaiah, as declared in Romans 4, verses 23 to 25. It is written that the Christ will be killed to atone, according to Isaiah 53, verses 4 to 6, and verses 11 to 12. And Jesus had to die to be vindicated, as Paul says in Philemon 2, verses 5 to 11. And we have evidence this text was probably understood by some in just this way, for the preeminent prophecy of the coming Messiah declares this very fate. Quote, "The Christ shall be utterly destroyed, yet there is no judgment upon him. Then the city and the sanctuary will be torn down by the ruler who shall come. They will be knocked down in a cataclysm until the end, when after war wreaks havoc, there will be a systematic extermination." End quote. That's in Daniel 9. This Jewish prophecy was widely known in the Jewish and Roman world, and interpreted in many different ways, by the Romans as presaging the crowning of Vespasian as emperor, and by the Jews as presaging a military victory over Rome, even though the prophecy plainly says their anticipated Messiah will be killed, despite his innocence, and that the Jews will be defeated, though later vindicated in the apocalypse. This Danielic prophecy is probably alluded to by Suetonius, stating that an ancient superstition was current in the East that out of Judea at this time would come the rulers of the world. Josephus states that the main reason the Jews made war on Rome, quote, was an ambiguous prophecy found in their sacred writings announcing that at that time someone from their country would become ruler of the world, end quote. Tacitus writes, quote, "In most there was a firm persuasion that in the ancient records of their priests was contained a prediction of how at this very time the East was to grow powerful and rulers coming from Judea were to acquire universal empire. And these mysterious prophecies had pointed to Vespasian and Titus, but the common people, with the usual blindness of ambition, had interpreted these mighty destinies of themselves and could not be brought even by disasters to believe the truth." End quote. The same prophecy's interpretation, as anticipating Christ's death in 30 AD, is attested by Julius Africanus, a Christian chronologer who laid it out 2 centuries later. As one can plainly see from the text itself, the Danielic prophecy predicts 2 men, an anointed, a Christ, who will be executed though innocent, and a ruler, a hegemon, who will destroy Jerusalem and its temple and conquer the world for a while, but then come to his end, according to Daniel 11, verse 45, after which shall be the apocalypse, Daniel 12, when all these injustices will be righted by God. So we have the lesson of the wisdom of Solomon, combined with Isaiah 52 to 53, which explicitly describes a humiliated servant of God who is subsequently exalted, and the way David could be imagined to speak of himself, humiliated and killed in Psalm 22, then sojourning in the land of the dead in Psalm 23, then exalted back to glory in Psalm 24. But most of all, we have Daniel 9, which outright says the Messiah will be unjustly killed, while Isaiah and the wisdom of Solomon confirm that he will then, like other righteous men, rise again in divine triumph. Holding argues that these messianic Old Testament passages I cite, describing a suffering righteous servant of God, were never used or interpreted as referring to the Messiah. Of course, he doesn't actually have evidence it was never so used. Holding can't prove his case by adducing evidence that some Jews saw things differently, since I only propose that some, not all Jews, held this conception. And unlike his invisible elite scholars, as I'll talk about in chapter 18, we know there were many diverse Jewish sects and views that do not survive in the record. So no argument from silence can establish the blanket negative that Holding's argument requires. Even so, I do not merely argue the possibility, but the actuality, and so I willingly accept the burden of proving my claim, and so I do. All the passages in text I have cited predate Christianity, and at least one clearly and unambiguously refers to the Messiah, while the others clearly support the same general picture. Holding foolishly proclaims that all Jews expected a Messiah who would successfully rout the Romans, even though the pre-Christian book of Daniel, a book written by Jews, says exactly the opposite. Quote, "The Christ shall be utterly destroyed, yet there is no judgment upon him," end quote. And then a ruler would come and destroy the temple, as the Romans did. The Septuagint actually has the word Christos in Daniel 9, verse 25, with chrisma in Daniel 9, verse 26, which refers to Christos by metonymy. And the original text has Mashiach, Messiah, in both passages. Thus, rather than expecting a Messiah to rout the Romans, some Jews plainly expected a Messiah to be killed, even though innocent, and thus fail to rout Judea's conquerors. Holden cannot claim this text is late, wasn't Jewish, or wasn't about the Messiah, for it says it's about the Messiah. That soundly refutes Holden. But let's look at my other evidence anyway. Some of it could be interpreted a different way, like Isaiah 49 or Psalms 22, and so those passages only support the plausibility of my point. But others are as clear as the passage from Daniel. For example, consider Isaiah 52 verse 7, all the way to Isaiah 53 verse 12. Quote, "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that brings the gospel, publishing peace, bringing the gospel of good things that announces salvation, that says to Zion, your God rules. For Jehovah has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. Behold, my servant shall deal wisely. He shall be exalted and lifted up and shall be very high. Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of Jehovah been revealed? For he grew up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He hath no form or comeliness. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And Jehovah has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, yet when he was afflicted, he opened not his mouth. As a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and as a sheep that before its shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who among them considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due? And they made his grave with the wicked, and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When you shall make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By the knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. Because he poured out his soul unto death, and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. End quote. Here we have a pre-Christian text, written by Jews, predicting that a righteous servant of God, chosen by God, shall suffer, be despised, and be buried a criminal, even though innocent, and then shall be exalted, raised up, and made great, and that in so doing he shall justify and heal the Jews, carry away their sorrows and sins, and the pleasure of Jehovah will prosper in his hand. How could any Jew not have understood this to mean that a righteous, wise, chosen servant of God would be wrongly despised, convicted, and executed, and in so doing save Israel from its sins and afflictions? That is, after all, exactly what the text says. Isaiah also says this servant will be cut off, though he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. Then Daniel, later says the Messiah will be cut off, though there is no legal judgment against him. These sure sound like the same man. In fact, it sounds like Daniel is alluding to Isaiah's servant and predicting that he will be the Messiah. Since scholars agree the Book of Daniel was actually written in the 2nd century BC, during a time of Greek persecution, it's quite possible the author had such an allusion in mind. Moreover, since Daniel 9 verse 26 is otherwise obscure and strange, but makes perfect sense once linked to Isaiah 52-53, it's reasonable to infer that Daniel 9 verse 26 is a messianic interpretation of Isaiah 52-53. Though the Hebrew employs different verbs in each case for kill, they both mean cut off. And though the following Hebrew is unclear, the later but still pre-Christian translation employed the Greek word krima for judgment, which connotes a formal legal judgment, thus clarifying that an unjust execution is what the author of Daniel had in mind. Hence, a shameful but undeserved death, exactly as Isaiah envisioned. Maybe this is too speculative for J.P. Holding. Sure, one might argue that a man who brings the gospel as the servant of God, who is righteous and shall be exalted, yet whose life shall be made an offering for sin, bring salvation and redeem all Israel, would not be understood as the Messiah. As improbable as that may seem, let's suppose no one saw the obvious. The text of Isaiah still predicts a righteous, innocent man who will bring the gospel and announce salvation, yet be shamed, humiliated, executed, and buried as a criminal, but whose death will bring salvation and atone for the sins of Israel. And the same text still predicts that this man will be accounted righteous and exalted by God after his shameful death. Therefore, even if no Jew understood this passage to be about the Messiah, it remains undeniable that all Jews would see this passage as predicting exactly what the Christians were preaching about Jesus. Therefore, there could be no stigma attached to a righteous man who exactly fit Isaiah's description, whether he was called the Messiah or not. The Jews clearly anticipated such a person, regardless of what formal title they cared to bestow on him. Either way, it's unreasonable to believe that no Jews understood these texts to refer to such a man, especially since it says God intends to send out a messenger to deliver the gospel that brings salvation, and that this man will be humiliated with a shameful but undeserved death, and then exalted thereafter. But even in general, Isaiah 52-53 still clearly preaches that a man like Jesus should be revered, and that even a man despised, shamed, and buried a criminal could and should be praised and exalted, so long as he was wise and innocent, as Jesus was. And this is enough to destroy Holding's premise that no Jew would see Jesus as worthy of reverence because of his ignoble fate. Quite the contrary, the Jews' own sacred text says we should revere such a man. So too also says Isaiah 50 verses 4 to 9. And that is exactly my point. The same teaching is clearly conveyed in the Wisdom of Solomon, which presents the very same lesson, that a righteous man, whose soul is blameless, yet is mistreated with insult and torture and wrongly condemned to a shameful death, that's in Wisdom of Solomon 2 verses 19 to 22, just compare Mark 15 verses 29 to 32, that this man is in fact a son of God, Wisdom of Solomon 2:13, 2:16, 2:18, and 5:5, who will be resurrected and crowned by God, in Wisdom of Solomon 3 and 5. Well, those who despise him will be condemned. This is all what the Wisdom of Solomon describes. This lesson certainly predates Christianity, which makes this another example of how Jewish values were primed for accepting the story of Jesus, not rejecting it. Indeed, the Wisdom of Solomon equates the fate of righteous men generally with the Son of God specifically. I quote,